Hi everyone. So today, what I'd like to do together is to spend just a few minutes sharing some Divrei Torah, some things that hopefully you can say over at your Seder table. If anyone's interested, I give a shiur also, a more expansive presentation on the notion of the symbolism of matzah. Matzah is the object of a reciprocal loving relationship between God and the Jewish people. So that's up on YU Torah, and you can find it there. In addition, though, I'd like to do is to share some shorter vorlach, little ideas that you might be able to share at your table, in addition to other material preparations, as well as other spiritual preparations for the Seder, in terms of thinking about how we can run our Seder in a meaningful sort of way. I'd like to just share a couple of vorlach, different things that contain hopefully some food for thought that are really stimulating and really interesting that potentially you could bring to your Seder table. So before we even jump in, we're going to go chronologically in order of the Haggadah with these Divrei Torah. So the first thing I want to talk about is before we even come to Kaddish or Chatz, etc., is to take a look at the Seder plate. And we know that there are different customs as to what is included on the Seder plate, but it's traditional to include certainly an egg as well as the shank bone. And I want to talk a little bit about the symbolism of the egg. There are many different explanations as to what it represents. What I'd like to do is to focus our attention on two in particular. And the first is suggested really, first and foremost, by the Nitziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the famed Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva in Volozhin. And in his introduction to his commentary to the Haggadah, the Nitziv points out that, first of all, as we know generally, the egg is symbolic of the Korban Chagiga, one of the sacrifices that was brought really on each of the Shalosh Regalim. When we were obligated to go up to the Beis HaMikdash, we had to bring various Korbanot, including the Korban Chagiga, which is embodied, which is symbolized, represented by this egg. But the Nitziv suggests that this idea that we have the egg and we have the Zeroa, the shank bone, on the table, on the Seder night, is more than just about being, it really is more than just about recalling something in ancient history. Instead, suggests the Nitziv, there's reason to believe that on the night of the Seder, we are actually reenacting, reliving the temple experience of the Jews so many years ago. So in other words, what we're doing is we are imagining ourselves not only as if we left Egypt today, but in particular, we are imagining ourselves as if we are dining over the Korban Pesach and the ideal experience of the Leil HaSeder with the Pesach and all the accoutrements and the full-fledged experience in context of the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. That's really what we are reenacting. In addition to the story of the Exodus, that we are imagining ourselves as if we're fulfilling Pesach in this sort of way. And then Tim suggests that there are a number of other practices that we have, and he points to two in particular that are consistent to his mind with this motif. Number one, that it points out that it's customary for the Baal Bayis or for someone or for multiple members, even in many households, to wear a kittel. Not everyone has this minhag, but many do. So the Tziv wonders why this is. So some suggest, as we'll come to momentarily, that this represents burial shrouds, big day basin. What does that have to do with Yetzias Mitzrayim? And the night of the Seder we'll come to again in just a moment. But the Tziv suggests something else. He says that actually the kittel represents big day malchus. It's something that's actually quite the opposite. It's very special. And why do we wear this special garment? And it says, it's not just because the Seder is an important or even magical evening. It's much more particular than that. There's a halacha that's associated with the sacrifice and the eating of a korban of lemashcha. And the pasuk uses this in term to korbanos, and Gemara in Maseches Chulin suggests that this denotes a certain substantial or significance, a weight that's assigned to the way in which we interact with a korban. There's a certain chashiva, so there's a certain substantial nature that's associated with the korban. And in that sense, then it suggests the kittel, the way that we dress, needs, the way that we comport ourselves, needs to be consistent with this theme of the chashivas of the korban. And so the Nitziv suggests that it's for the same reason that we're imagining as if we're actually eating, dining from the korban Pesach, the night of the Seder, that's really the idea that the kittel is meant to represent. And one more, the Nitziv uses this to explain one of the otherwise most inexplicable parts of the Seder. And to me, there are a couple of stages during the Seder that are most puzzling, and high in that list, it would seem to be Urchatz, right? Urchatz, Kadesh Urchatz, right there toward the beginning. We know we typically wash our hands, although it's not always obvious. We don't always appreciate why it is that we do this in the first place, but Rachza, we're familiar with washing over bread and reciting the bracha and not interrupting and all of that. But what of the washing of the hands here, right? This is completely inconsistent with everything that we teach our children and that people who are growing up in the frum community, they learn, right? You wash your hands over bread, right? You say the bracha, and then you go, right? All of that. We know that's quite traditional. But to not say the bracha, to be able to talk before we go ahead and have our vegetable instead of dipped in salt water, instead of our bread, where is this coming from? So the truth is, those who are familiar with this topic know that really it makes good sense. And in fact, even it's a din shulchan aruch, not to before eating fruit. A dry fruit, really, one is supposed to prepare in this way. And the reason is because really fundamentally very similar to the reason that we wash for the bread. It's commemorative. It recalls the truma, which was eaten by the Kohanim with a certain degree of purity, and as a gezerah, lest that be forgotten. The Gemara in Chulin says that the enactment of Netilas Yadayim came of that. But the truth is that, as the Netziv points out, it's not common for us to observe that practice anymore in most of our community, despite the din of the Shulchan Aruch and the Shita and the Rishonim that we should wash our hands for such items in addition to just when it comes to bread. So, but that's not the common practice. So the Netziv says, why all of a sudden do we do this on the night of the Seder? So it comes along and the Netziv says, because although we don't accept this practice all year round, there's one night when we imagine ourselves as if we're Bizman HaMikdash. And during the Zman HaMikdash, this was a din, this was a halachic requirement, a strict halachic requirement at that. And therefore it says in the Netziv, that's where Urchatz comes in. That's the reason that we do it. It's Davrish Dibulo B'mashka. We don't have that practice anymore. But the Lela Seder, Bizman Shabbos HaMikdash HaYakayim, that's exactly what we're embodying, what we're reenacting on this night. And so therefore, that's something that we do. So in sum, there are three symbols according to the Netziv. The first brief idea I want to share of the symbolism of the Beitza, of the egg, along with the shankbone, the kittel, and Urchatz, the washing of the hands, that this all represents this idea that we're trying to go back to the time that the Beis HaMikdash Haya Kayim. That's one explanation. Excuse me, one explanation for the symbolism of the egg and one idea that I wanted to share. In addition to this, there's another explanation that's offered for the egg. There are a number, but one that I think is especially striking and worth highlighting tonight. There's another, perhaps, unexpected connection that is drawn in this regard. And that's between the egg and really Pesach in general, to, surprisingly, the saddest time of the year, Tisha B'Av. We know that although it might not be immediately obvious or intuitive, that there are a number of significant connections that many have observed between these two. First of all, there's a classic Atbash, there's a classic Gematria that connects the first night of a series of holidays, the first night, or the different days of Pesach, and a series of holidays over the course of the year. The Aleph, the first night of Pesach, corresponds in our calendar to Tish Abav. The first night of Pesach is always the same night and day of the calendar as Tish Abav falls out. And while this might just be a quirk of the calendar and a way of ensuring that we actually know when the different holidays are meant to fall out and so on and so forth, it seems that it's more than just a mnemonic device, that there are a number of parallels between the two. With regard to the egg, so many have suggested that an egg is, of course, the symbol of Avelos, Sudas Avra, and Avel's going to eat from the egg as part of the first meal after the burial, after the kfura. And the egg, of course, is part of what we eat, is part of the symbolism of Avelos, the Galgal HaChayim, that we eat as part of the Seudah HaMafseket that immediately precedes Tisha B'Av. Not only that, but there are a number of other parallels between the two, having to do with the idea that really, in many ways, these are the two poles of redemption. I was thinking about that this past year when Tisha B'Av fell out specifically on Motzei Shabbos, and we recite the Kina that we only say when Tisha B'Av falls out, Motzei Shabbos, the Ashkenazi Kinos, V'hinoam Nishbas, Motzei Shabbos, that we mourn the fact, we declare, we note the fact that V'hinoam is omitted on Motzei Shabbos. And the question is why that is, and there are a number of explanations that are offered, but I wanted to suggest Misvara, But the whole idea of Vihi Noam is it's really a tefillah for success in Parnassa in the coming week. And that on the night of Tisha B'Av, we're actually unable to daven. So some tefillahs, see, we say that our prayers have been stifled. We're not able to successfully engage in petitionary prayer on the dark night of Tisha B'Av. Therefore, Vihi Noam Nishbas, we don't say Vihi Noam. And that in of itself is a symbol, is a marker, is a symbol of the darkness of this night. And in many ways that connects to the idea of Pesach. Pesach is the night when we are able to be celebrating and we are able to turn to God with our tefillos and really with our praise to God. And then that's part of the sharp contrast between the two. In fact, if you take a look at the Sephardic Kinos, at least certain Edot HaMizrach, the version of the Kinos actually includes a striking Kino that compares and contrasts between the Exodus from Egypt and the experience of the Jews, and they were exiled specifically on the night of Tisha B'Av. And again, drawing these comparisons, and there are Midrashim that suggest this comparison explicitly in the Latin Al-Varosh, and this is a larger motif. So the symbolism of the egg might actually go to the idea of Tisha B'Av, and ultimately, although at first glance it seems depressing, actually it's quite powerful. We know that Tisha B'Av, of course, is at once the greatest day of mourning over the course of the Jewish year, and at the same time is the harbinger of redemption, that as the afternoon comes around, that there's a certain lifting of depression, that it's considered to be perhaps, according to tradition, the birthday of the Messiah, of Mashiach. And so that Tisha B'Av becomes this harbinger. And it's almost as if what we're saying is that actually Pesach is uplifted and transformed. That just as the Haftorahs and a number of other practices on Pesach that we engage in are really meant to indicate that Pesach is ultimately meant to be the model for future redemptions. V'neomar lefanav shira chadasha is exactly what we daven for at the very end of Maggid. So too, that's really ultimately it's leading toward Tisha B'Av. Although at first glance it might seem like a negative, like a downer, and it's a symbol of mourning. Nonetheless, just as on Pesach itself, we're meant to begin with degradation, maschal b'gnos, u'mesayim b'shvach, but ultimately conclude with the praise and with the exaltation of the redemption and our thanksgiving to God as a consequence of His great beneficence to our people. So too, that's really very much meant to be a model for the kind of exaltation that Yitzias Mitzrayim is meant to model for us as we look ultimately toward the Gula HaAtidah, which ultimately is symbolized by the very same Tisha B'Av, which is a time of tremendous tragedy and mourning. So this idea of going Mishibud the Gula, the beginning of Tisha B'Av until its end, and this transformation from the egg of mourning to the Galgal Chaim that ultimately that reverses itself and comes full circle and ultimately is a harbinger of redemption is actually quite a powerful and I think a very important symbol on the Seder night. And I think that the egg really represents that idea of Geula, in addition to the idea of reenacting or reliving time of the Eis HaMikdash. And it's possible that ultimately these two symbolisms of the egg coalesce. And by the way, sorry, I should go back for a second and explain that. Right? We can also add that as I said earlier, the Kitzel, according to some, is Bigdei Mason. That's what I was saying earlier, that could represent sort of the mourning aspect of the eggs. So now to come back, right, these two explanations of the egg, that it's meant to, it's about reliving Zman Shebeis HaMikdash HaYakayim, going back to the Chagiga, and at the same time looking toward both Avelos and ultimately toward redemption, it could be that these are two sides of the same coin, that ultimately what we're doing is we're going back and imagining for ourselves what that experience was once upon a time as a way of hinting toward and praying for ultimately the opportunity to relive and to re-experience, not from the past, but rather in the future, this experience, the full experience of the Lohas Seder during the time of the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. So those are two themes with regards to the Seder plate. Let's turn now to Kadesh in general, so the four cups of wine. This is great because you can use this spread out throughout the course of the Seder night. I want to make two points with regard to the symbolism of the four cups. The first one I heard initially from Rabbi J.J. Schachter. Rabbi Schachter pointed out that it's very interesting that often when we're young, our children are young, they or we are taught that the significance of the symbolism of the Arba Kosot really based on the Yerushalmi, but Rashi and Rashbam at the beginning of Perek Arvei Psachim cite this as well, that it's representative of the Arba Lishon Shekula, the four languages of redemption, Veltsesi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilakachti. And then the fifth cup, for those who have for Eliyahu Navi, that's Vehebesi, that's entering the land of Israel. Truth is, if you take a look at the Yerushalmi more carefully, it does not say Arba Lishon Shekula. What it actually says is something very interesting, Arba Geulot, four redemptions. And at first glance, this notion, this motif of four redemptions, seems very strange. After all, what do you mean? There's one redemption. We were taken out of Egypt. What are you talking about? Four redemptions? What does that mean? And so Rabbi Schachter suggested, and I think it's a very powerful explanation, that no, that the Arba Geulos, Veltsesi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilakachti, actually are indicative of the fact that Geula itself is a textured, complex, back and forth, layered sort of process. That we understand that Judaism is extremely realistic, and that Yetzias Mitzrayim was not a simple matter. It wasn't just, yes, it was one fell swoop from one perspective, but it was quite complex or back and forth in terms of the Jews' level of commitment, in terms of Moshe Rabbeinu's willingness to step up, in terms of Paro changing his mind, back and forth. He's going to let us go, he's not going to let us go. The Jews being prepared, Jews being unprepared to leave Egypt. It was rather complex. Even when we were redeemed, according to the Zohar, we were on the 49th level of Tumah, and we were heading for number 50. We required spiritual preparation in order to receive the Torah. Even when we did get the Torah, we went and we worshipped the eagle, and we complained about, we remembered the good old days when we were in Egypt, and so on and so forth. It's a very complex process, Geula. It's not a straight line. It's not a simple thing. It's not one Geula. It's Arba Geulos. There are many different phases of redemption. And one can suggest, and Rabbi Schachter, I think, suggested as well, that this is true when we think about the model of Geula nowadays. And we struggle with this question. Reishit Tzmicha Geulatino. Is this a time of redemption? Is it not a time of redemption? This is really what redemption looks like. There's so much that we have to do. There's still significant strife and challenges that we face both within and without. There's so many challenges. And the question becomes this. Is the Geula? And the answer is yes. And the answer is that Geula, again, does not go in a straight line. And I would add, I don't know if Rabbi Schachter mentioned this, but during the time of Shivat Zion, the period of Ezra Nehemiah, very similar challenges. A small 10% of the Jewish people, maybe 50,000 Jews, return from exile. They're impoverished. They are beset by challenges, enemies, and all sorts of severe existential questions. They rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Some celebrate, but those who had seen the first Beis HaMikdash understood that this was a mere shadow compared to the first temple. And so those people who had seen the first temple began to cry. The mixture of emotions, the ambivalence that the Jews experience, is this Geula, is this not Geula, a very similar kind of experience. And what was true of the Jews of Egypt, what was true of the Jews at the time of Ezra Nehemiah, and what's true today as we think about our successes and the challenges that continue to face us in Medina Israel, I think it's true of us on individual levels as well. And this can be a conversation at our Seder table. What does Geula mean? What does it mean to be redeemed? What does it mean to have a partial Geula? What does it mean to have partial successes? What does it mean to say Dayenu? What does it mean for us to give Shira to God on any number of stages over the course of our life or our experiences, whether they be in Egypt or in a personal sense, even if they're incomplete, even if they couldn't possibly stand on their own? This question of the realistic approach of Judaism, the Arba Geula, I think is a very powerful one with contemporary resonance, and I think more than that, extreme relevance for our own struggles and the realities of the imperfections, and yet the importance of celebrating the accomplishments of our own lives, both material and spiritual. So that's not just Arba Lishonot Shegula, but really the Arba Geulot. That's the first idea I wanted to share with regards to the four cups. The other point is not based on the idea of Rabbi Schachter. In this case, it's an idea that I heard developed. I actually came up with this idea independently, part of it, but then I heard it developed very beautifully, in particular by Rabbi Riskin. So I'm going to give Rabbi Riskin credit for this. Of course, Rabbi Riskin in part was in turn citing from the Haggadah of Rav Shlomo Kluger. It's Rav Shlomo Kluger. If we really get the Davar Ha'omer Davar B'Shem Omro B'Shem Omro, say in the name of the person, say in the name of someone else, I think we hit all of those requirements, the Gemara Megillah tonight. So the point that Rabbi Riskin made was that if you take a look at the Yerushalmi, the truth is the Yerushalmi offers a whole range of explanations as to the basis for the four cups of wine. It's not just the four Geulos, there are other explanations as well. And one of the most striking is that Yerushalmi says the four cups of wine that we enjoy, that we drink, on the night of the Seder correspond to the four cups of the butler's dream, as interpreted by Yosef HaTzadik in Mitzrayim. And this is a very interesting kind of idea, because Ma'inyan Yosef HaTzadik eats all the Seder. At first glance, Yosef has little or nothing to do with anything that we're talking about. The night of the Seder, where did Yosef get in here? How does this have anything to do with anything? But the truth is, if we take a look at the Haggadah, Rabbi Riskin suggested, and look at it a little bit more carefully, we can see that the truth is that the theme of Yosef keeps on popping up in a couple of other places as well. So that, for example, when it comes to Karpas. Karpas is very interesting, because Karpas, if you even think about it for a moment, taking one item and dipping it into something that is bitter or negative, something else, that even that actual imagery seems to be evocative, possibly, of the brothers dipping the coat, right? The Ksones Pasim in the goat's blood. And what's more is something truly remarkable. Question is, what exactly was this Ksones Pasim? So if you take a look at Rashi on that Pasuk, that V'aviva Salo Ksones Pasim, which appears in Parshat Vayishev, Bereishit, Perek, Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Kimo, Rashi explains what this Ksones Pasim consisted of by citing the verse in the first Perek of Megillat Esther, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Vav, says Rashi, it's based on Chur Karpas Utechela, that it consisted of Tehillah, and that was a royal blue, it was a royal hue, right? So similar to this, by the way, that's Tehillah represents royalty. I think there's very strong evidence. The Ramban says this, there's strong archaeological evidence that he alludes to, but the updated evidence that we have today, to the best of my knowledge, strongly confirms this. That's why the Kohanim wore it, that's why they wore it as part of their Big Day Kuna, that's why the Mishkan was adorned in that way, and that's also the symbolism on the Tehillah. It's a sign of either God's melucha or of our being elevated by our association with God in that way. So Chur Karpas Utchilat, in other words, the idea seems to be that Karpas, whatever exactly that is, the spring vegetable or what have you, initially was a representative of some sort of tapestry that was extremely valuable, extremely expensive, that went along with the Tchilas, and that when Rashi, on the basis of this Rashi, Rav Shlomo Kluger actually makes this point, that actually that's really what the Karpas is meant to allude to, that the Karpas is an allusion to the Ksones Pasim of Yosef. And so what we're reenacting is we're taking the Ksones Pasim of Yosef with the Karpas and we're dipping in something else. Right? Perhaps it would have been even more striking and more compelling if it would have been into blood or into wine or something like that, but you can already see the striking similarities between the two. And again, Rav Shlomo Kluger says this idea quite explicitly. The third context in the Haggadah, or at least according to one interpretation, we find a connection between Yosef and the night of the Seder, comes all the way at the end, bookending the story or our experience in the night of the Seder. And that I refer specifically to the Vilna Gaon's classic explanation of the song of Chad Gadya. The Vilna Gaon explains Chad Gadya, what's this Chad Gadya deserve an Abba that a father bought for Trey Zuzay? So says the Gaon, the Abba was Yaakov Avinu, the Trey Zuzay are the two zoos that he spent in order to fashion the cloak of Yosef. And the story of Haggadah is a story about how, ultimately, it's a story of the exile, according to the Vilna Gaon. It's a story of many exiles of the Jewish people, but that ultimately, they all began with the Haggadah, with the one goat, the Zavin Abba B'Truzeza. In other words, the goat, not that he bought the actual goat, but the idea is that it was that goat that the father, quote-unquote, acquired. In other words, through spending the two zoos in order to adorn Yosef with the Ksones Pasim, that led to the whole episode, to the brothers' jealousy, and to them ultimately selling Yosef down to Mitzrayim, considering killing him, but ultimately selling him, and dipping the coat in the blood. Yaakov, as it were, quote-unquote, acquired for himself all of these tsaros, the tsaros of the galos, of the exile of the Jewish people, ultimately began with that incident. And so in our experience, in a way, it's as it were starting with Kaddish and going to Karpas, in other words, the earlier parts of the Seder, and then the end of the Seder, in a way one can suggest that there's sort of a bracketing that takes place. And the symbolism of this idea would seem to be, and I believe Rabbi Riskin puts it this way as well, is that as part of the telling of the story, obviously the major focus of the night of the Seder is the central thrust is Shevach V'Hodah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's focusing on the events of the Exodus themselves, and yet around the edges there's a memory of it, without judging Yaakov, but a recognition that this incident in which the favoritism of one brother or the others led to terrible internecine strife within the family, and ultimately, in a way, led to all the events. Everything was miskalga mishan, just as we say in Chad Gadya, but ultimately that comes back to the story of Yosef. And so part of the message, ultimately, of the Seder, at least in the back of our minds, even if it's not at the forefront, but it's in the background, is this idea of the dangers of favoritism, the importance of ensuring harmony within one's family, the importance of ensuring harmony within the Jewish community, that ultimately if that gets thrown off kilter, ultimately all sorts of tragic events can emerge from such difficulty, from such machloket, and that ultimately between the lines the Haggadah is urging us to recognize the importance of that incident, and it hints that to us already in the context of the four cups and the imagery and the symbolism of the four cups of Yosef as alluding to the four cups of the butler's dream. Okay, so we've said our Kaddish, and we move on. We said a little word about Karpas as part of that as well. And I want to come now to say just a few short words about Yachat. So we break the middle matzah. One of the interesting things is that there is, we know the Ashkenazic practice is to have three matzahs, but Svardim will know that it's common Svardic practice to have just two matzahs. That was the opinion of the Rambam, and many Svardim have that practice on that basis as well. Well, what's going on over here? So let's take the Ashkenazic practice for a moment and try to understand why would you say three. That also helps explain the Shita of the Rambam and the Sephardim. Right? So the simple explanation is that the reason you have three is because, right, despite what we learn Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, and all these Divrei Torah, but ultimately it's a halachi point that on the night of the Seder, just like any Shabbos and perhaps Yom Tov as well, we require Lechem Mishnah, and if we require Lechem Mishnah, we generally require two whole loaves, as on Shabbos, assuming that applies to Yom Tov as well, so then it would make sense to say that we require three matzahs, because one of them is going to be broken, right? That's Yachat, so we put it away for the Alfi Komen. So two whole matzahs for Lechem Mishnah, like we require any time, and then the additional matzah is broken, so we use that in its own way for the Alfi Komen separately as well. So this is for the Motzi Matzah, we require Lechem Mishnah. And then perhaps the Rambam is saying, the Rambam actually says quite explicitly that no, that it's Kiviyachah, as it were, the matzah that's broken on the night of the Seder, that is considered quote-unquote whole, not that it's physically whole, but the requirement of whole is that it be as perfectly tailored for that night or for that time as possible. And so the Rambam seems to say that actually the definition of the matzah of Lechem Oni is able to even impact on the definition of how we understand the mitzvah of Lechem Mishnah, which is a whole shir in its own right. So that's one explanation for the three matzahs, and then maybe how the Rambam would respond. But there's another explanation. This is what I really want to focus on, that some of the Chachmi Ashkenaz, the later medieval Ashkenazic scholars, such as some cited in the Mordechai, offer, let's say, 13th to 15th century Rishon, Ashkenazic Rishonim, offer for the number three. And the other explanation that they offer is that ultimately the matzah, actually, there's another symbolism in the matzah, namely the matzah represents the Korban Todah, the sacrifice of Thanksgiving. What are we talking about over here? So the Korban Todah is based on the Psukim in Parshas Tzav, and the Gemara elaborates that one, at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, brought the Korban Todah, or nowadays recites Birchat Hagoma, which is the modern-day substitute for the Korban Todah, upon having survived one of four life-threatening experiences. If someone was ill, desperately ill, if someone was imprisoned, if someone survived a journey over the sea, or someone survived a trip through the desert. In any of those four experiences, someone who survived, based on the Mizmor in Tehillim, Hodu Lashem Kito, who we recite on the night of Yom Ha'atzmaut as well, that one who survived one of these experiences, these travails, thanks God by offering the Korban Todah. Now, generally speaking, none of the Korbanos included any Chametz in the Beis HaMikdash, with two exceptions. One exception is the Shteil Lechem, and the other exception is 10 out of the 40 loaves of bread that accompanied the Korban Todah. Because in addition to the actual animal sacrifice, we also offered four types of 10 loaves of bread each. One kind was chametz, and so 10 of those loaves altogether were chametz, and three types, in other words, 30 altogether, were were matzah. Not only that, but really b'di'evit, you could have one of each type, and you could have four, and you were yotze if need be. That's what we learn in the sugyos in Maseches Menachos. So the Chafei Ashkenaz suggests that the three matzahs that we eat on the Seder night are actually representative of the three types of matzah that someone who's offering the Korban Todah would bring. Not only that, but I just happened to see a suggestion. This is just another drush, but it's very interesting to think about, that it's possible to argue that the Jewish people at the time of the redemption from Egypt actually experienced not just one of these, but all four of these experiences, any one of which would have been enough to say halal, right? Dayenu, but we actually experienced all four. So it's pretty straightforward, but not 100% perfect, but it's a nice idea to consider al pi drush. So the idea that we were in a desert and we survived, right? So that's certainly a check. The idea that we were seafaring and made it through, well, we weren't on boats, but we certainly walked through water, as it were, and miraculously were saved from the Egyptians at the time of the Yom Suf. You have the idea of someone who was in prison, so we weren't behind bars per se, but certainly we were enslaved. It's certainly a sort of a form of very much a form of imprisonment with a small twist. And then the last one, someone who was terribly ill. So I don't know if we were terribly ill, but certainly the beatings that we had to withstand as part of our bondage certainly are quite similar to physical illness, and presumably would have been an experience of survival that one would have necessitated the recitation of Birchat HaGomel. So it's possible to argue that we actually experienced all four when we emerged from Egypt, and there's reason to read the Perek in Tehillim in this way as well. It's Mork of Zion. So the idea seems to be that really what we are experiencing or describing over here is really something quite remarkable. That according to the Chachmei Ashkenaz, the reason that we have the three matzahs is not just Kohen Levi Yisrael, it's not even just Lechem Mishnah. It's actually meant to represent the idea that the matzah symbolizes the Korban Todah that we bring on this holiday. Because through our experiences and through the traumas that we survived, ultimately, we were obligated to offer a Korban Todah, and that's exactly what we describe here in these psukim, which I think is a very powerful and beautiful idea. Okay, so that's one more. I want to share just a few other quick thoughts, and we will call it a shir. And there's God willing, a good amount of material. There's much more, but we certainly have a number of wonderful ideas. Hopefully we can share at our Seder table. So one or two other very quick thoughts. So one other quick thought is just to point out that it's very interesting that if we take a look at the symbols of the mitzvos of the Seder night, I want to look at four. Matzah, karpas, the arbakosis again, and maror. And again, this is the reserve. You can give it various points during your Seder and can fit this in lots of different places. But it's interesting to think about that we mentioned before that there's an idea that we begin with degradation, we end with praise. Maschil b'gnos u'mesayim b'shvach. And the truth is, this idea of dialectical symbolism is rife throughout the Seder night, and in particular is found in even unexpected symbols on this night. So I want to demonstrate very briefly that all these four, and I heard parts of this, a lot of it maybe even from Rabbi Schachter as well, that parts of these following mitzvahs actually share in this dual symbolism that we discuss or that we describe on the Lechem Seder. So the first one is matzah. Matzah is pretty easy because matzah itself we describe in contradictory ways at various points over the course of the Seder. On the one hand, in Halach Man, we say this is the poor man's bread that we ate when we were enslaved in Egypt. And then later on during Rabban Gamliel, what do we say? The matzah is Hashanah Ochle and Al Shumma, based on the Mishnah in the 10th parak of Psachim, that the reason that we eat the matzah is because they were rushing out of Egypt, right? So they had no choice. They had to quickly bake the matzah. In other words, it's not what they ate when they were enslaved, but rather it's what they ate on the way out. It's not a sign of servitude. Rather, it's a sign of redemption. Matzah is a mixed symbol. Matzah itself, that one piece of matzah, each piece of matzah, has two almost opposite explanations that are associated with it. Same with karpas. Karpas has two opposite explanations and symbolisms. On the one hand, the spring vegetable, a sign of redemption, a sign of gula. And then we dip it in the salt water. Meriros, bitterness. Which one is it? Here we take the two different elements and we fuse them together. It's a little different than matzah, but it ultimately is very similar. We take two dialectically opposed, two opposite explanations or symbols, and we put them together intentionally. And the truth is, this dialectical symbolism exists even in two additional additional mitzvos that one might not have expected them to come up in regard. So for example, the four cups, if I were to ask you, that's very clearly geula. The Gemara very clearly says, right? It's the Arba Lashonot Shegeula and the Tcherus, and the Gemara very much confirms this idea. And yet the Taz, when the Great Achronim points out that the four cups of wine, the minhag is to use the hue of red because it's meant to be Zecher Ladan, and it's actually a commemoration of the blood that was spilled, whether at the Exodus or future times of suffering over the course of Jewish history, the Crusades or Gezeros Tachvatat or what have you, but there's an element of bitterness, of misery, of suffering that is embodied in the four cups as well. So even one of the great signs of redemption, the Arba Kosos, which seems to be purely positive, has another element, another dimension to it as well. And on the flip side, if I were to ask you what is the most negative symbol of the Seder, so presumably you would join me in saying Maror. Maror is a bitter herbs. So you'll tell me, but those of us who eat romaine lettuce, and that's actually halachically the best thing, most appropriate thing to eat for the Seder, and we should at least have that. I'm going to have the horseradish as well, so because hey, but really the romaine lettuce is the essential Maror. You'll tell me it's not so bitter. Okay, but ultimately, however you explain that away, right, it is meant to be a bitter herb in its essence. And so you would think that's clearly the sign of Mariros. But the truth is that back at the time of Chumash, the Jewish community was obligated in Parshas Bo, Amatzosu Marorim Yochluhu, that the Maror was meant to be eaten together with Korban Pesach. You know, Maror Bizmana says only Chiv Midrabanan. The only Chiv Min HaTorah of Maror is to eat it together with the Korban Pesach. Either that together with the Korban Pesach that generates an independent mitzvah of Maror, or more likely from the Shita of the Rambam, that Maror actually is just an element of the mitzvah Sechilas HaPesach, eat the Pesach together with Maror. But either way, that was the initial mitzvah. And there's reason to suspect. And the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, in his commentary to Parshas Bo, actually explains, he says, the reason that we initially ate it is because that's how you ate meat. You eat meat. It was like a condiment. It was like mustard or ketchup or something like that. You ate it together with this vegetable, with the maror. Right? That's why amatso sumrorim yochluhu. It wasn't meant to necessarily be negative. It was part of the opposite, right? Adrabah was part of the eating the Pesach, which is a great representation, a great symbol of freedom, of liberation, and commemoration of the Exodus, and so on and so forth. So there is a sense in which the idea that even Maror, the great symbol that is negative in nature, also has a positive dimension to it as well. So whether it comes to matzah, it comes to karpas, it comes unexpectedly to the Arba Kosos in one direction or the Maror in the opposite, we find this dialectical opposing symbolism that is woven into the very same symbols themselves have multiple meanings. And I think this is quite profound. It touches in a way on the Arba Geulos, on the complexity of redemption. It also touches on the complexity of our own lives. We know that there's rarely any experience that we have that's purely one extreme or the other. That over the course of our lives, we experience all sorts of things, that just as the Jews did during the Tiyas Mitzrayim, and that very often our experience of Geula really is complex. And that there are multiple elements or dimensions to it. That on the one hand, there could be the happiest, most joyous moment of our lives, and yet precisely at that moment, there's a certain degree of poignancy in which we're at the celebratory occasion, we're at the wedding or what have you, and we remember those family members who are not with us. We remember that which is lacking or not fully perfect. We recall the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, in particular at the time with the breaking of the cup, that we recall even at our the moments of the greatest heights of our joy, sometimes in the back of our minds as human beings, rightfully so, there are elements in which we remember that there's something that somehow is lacking. And on the flip side as well, even sometimes those who go through traumatic experiences, sometimes they're just dark, but sometimes unexpectedly there's a certain strength that emerges from the experience. There's a certain insight, there's a certain ability to empathize with others who are undergoing an experience. So many people that I've spoken with who have gone through and undergone various traumas over the course of their lives are able to testify and to share that somehow through the negativity of the experience, they never would have wanted to go through it in the first place once they had to endure these difficulties, that there was some positive element that came out as well. And so I think there's a profound realism. One of the things I think is so refreshing about Judaism is that it is idealistic and yet realistic. We couldn't be anything but realistic given what we've survived and what we've experienced over the course of our history. But more than that there's an acute insight into human nature, and that Really, the mixed symbols of the Haggadah are really so realistic and so powerful and so resonant with our own human experiences as well. And so my bracha to all of us is that we should take all the realistic experiences that we have over the course of our lives, and we should all bring them all to the Seder, just as we don't experience anything purely one way or the other. Even when we do, the larger arc of our lives has complexity, has ups and downs, has bumps in the road, and yet moments of great exaltation and great joy and a great sense of connection, belonging, truly of geula. We should bring all of those to our Seder, that our family members should bring all of their experiences to our Seder, and that through channeling our own life experiences and then trying to map them to the best of our ability onto the experience of the Jews so many thousands of years ago, as we try to reenact their experience and also at the same time recall the time of the Beis HaMikdash that once was, and as well as anticipate the time of Mashiach, the time of the ultimate Tisha B'Av Geula, where that connection will be complete, that hopefully we'll be able to truly experience that in a meaningful way, and that by bringing all of our life experiences to the Seder, we should merit to truly be Mascha B'Gnus and Masayim B'Shvach, to have a true, holistic, complete experience at the night of the Seder for ourselves, our families, and for all of Klal Yisrael. Chag Kasher v'Sameach to all.